G'day listeners, I'm Edgars Grester and you're listening to The Business of Biodiversity. Birds are an iconic feature of our Australian environment. And whether you're in the bush or the backyard, they play an important role with things like keeping pesky insects at bay, pollinating plants, and did you know, in some cases they can even increase your property values. But sadly, loss of habitat across both urban and agricultural landscapes has impacted many species of birds, with some becoming endangered or threatened. So in this episode, we're talking to a bunch of passionate twitchers who are creating habitat for some threatened species to help nurture the birds and ensure they have a future.
My name's Leanne Ledden. I live in Wambarra on the south coast of New South Wales. I have been creating a bird-friendly garden for 10 years that now to date has attracted over 50 bird species on my suburban block. That is approximately 850 square metres. And I just couldn't imagine living without them now. I think I need them in my life every day. Yeah, just the benefits of living with them. It really brings peace and sense of place. The birds truly keep me connected to the natural world and they just have added so much beauty to my life.
Everybody has a bird story. There are so many people that are birders that don't identify themselves as birders. If you go out and you see something and you're really interested and you look up what it is, welcome, you are a birder.
That's Dr. Holly Parsons from BirdLife Australia.
Starting young and experiencing birds or nature through an organisation or an individual that just has that passion and passing it on, I think is really important. And I can remember my dad pointing out various, you know, different birds along trips or, you know, at home.
There's a flip side to us having more interactions with birds, which is that we're taking up space where birds used to live.
Habitat loss and habitat modification are huge impacts on wildlife in general. In terms of an urban space, there are some birds that actually do really, really well in the type of environments that we create in an urban landscape, but there are a whole lot that really struggle. Surprisingly, though, urban areas are really quite diverse places for birds. You know, there's something like 600 of Australia's bird species, of which there are, depending on your list, 830 odd, that have been found in urban areas. So urban spaces do have the potential to support birds, but we can make life very, very difficult for them in an urban area unless you are something like a rainbow lorikeet or an Australian magpie or a noisy miner. Life can be very tough.
I think the major threats are definitely habitat loss.
Ben Humphreys is from BirdLife Australia, working with rural landholders on bird monitoring and habitat restoration projects. And he echoes Holly's observations.
It was once possible to walk from places like Melbourne through to Sydney and be surrounded by the beautiful temperate woodland forest all the way. But with development and urban sprawl and communities popping up, you know, we're in a very highly fertile southwest slopes of the Slopes to Summit region, which is a very profitable agriculture space. So land clearing has been a considerable threat to our biodiversity and particularly woodland birds. Also things like cats a big problem for the woodland birds, but also, you know, the common things like pollution that are fouling waterways in various places. Yeah, I suppose the impacts of a growing community. So a real big focus for our project is to raise awareness of those threats and how we can help to turn those things around.
You know, of course, if you want to talk big picture, then we look at impacts of climate change on our wildlife as well across the board. You know, we're going to see shifts in distribution of birds because certain plants are not going to be able to be found in our different locations. We're going to see this huge change in how birds cope in the next really short term now.
One of those birds is the powerful owl. And by collecting data with the help of citizen scientists, Holly and her team have observed some significant changes in their behaviour.
They're this really unusual bird because they are a threatened species. They are a top order predator. You know, we consider them a large forest owl. Yet Sydney has become a real stronghold for their population. In the 90s, powerful owls were not common in Sydney at all. If one appeared, you know, Twitchers have told me that everybody would flock to see it because it was such a rare occurrence. And since we've been running this Powerful Owl project since 2011, we've now got something like 250 odd territories of powerful owls that have been documented in Greater Sydney. So it's been amazing to watch this threatened species adapt to urban life. We're starting to now, through at least through just the early look that we, first lot of data we've got, is that the birds are not moving anywhere near as much as we thought. There are these very distinct subpopulations genetically of powerful owls. So why are they not moving across the landscape if we've got good canopy, particularly through northern Sydney? What's going on? We've started to sadly note where they are dying and building up, unfortunately, this mortality database, which has raised questions about impacts of rat poison on powerful owls. And that work is starting to show that, yes, these guys are getting poisoned, and that is a really, really bad thing. So what do we need to do as individuals? So the Powerful Owl Project is another great way that individuals can get involved. If they're in Greater Sydney, they can look up the Powerful Owl Project, and we'll be holding training sessions next year if people want to get out and see some very, very cool birds.
Education and engagement is a key part of BirdLife Australia's mission. Ben and Holly work with rural and urban landowners respectively, hosting a range of events and educational programs. One of those focusing on urban environments is the Backyard Bird Count, which has been going for over 20 years now.
So that's a way for people to learn about how to create great bird-friendly spaces and also to contribute to citizen science. So through the bird data tool that BirdLife Australia has, people can do a 20-minute count in their garden as part of a Birds in Backyard survey and tell us what their garden is like. So we capture data on, I hate to say it, a bird's eye view of their garden and how things are structured. So if they have mostly native plants or mostly introduced, if they've got lots of trees or just a few trees, and also what behaviour goes on in that garden. So do you feed birds? Do you put water out? Do you have dogs in the yard? And so we can look at that data and start to see habitat preferences or behavioural preferences for different birds, which then informs how we encourage people to create better bird-friendly spaces.
Leanne Ledden, who we heard from at the start of the show, has been doing the Backyard Bird Count since 2017, and she's cultivated a bird oasis in her garden.
When you walk into my property, it's basically a tranquil rainforest corridor with a lovely understory of plants. And this corridor leads you up to the centre of the garden and the eastern boundary, which is like a bushland setting. So it takes you from a rainforest setting and then all of a sudden you're in like a bushland setting. And this area has many trees with dense understory plants as well, which is very important for the smaller birds. And the bushland setting continues up along the southern boundary that leads you up to the top of a hill. And this is where I love to sit also and view not only the dramatic landscape of the Illawarra Escarpment, though the bird life. Sitting up there, I've loved viewing the goshawks, white-bellied sea eagles, black-shouldered kites, Australian ravens, but my favourite cockatoo I love to view is the yellow-tailed black cockatoos. It's just their loud, majestic calls that just carry across the Illawarra landscape while in flight. Yeah, that's just something I can't get enough of. The sound is simply exhilarating.
But Leanne's backyard wasn't always a bird oasis. Local birds would often fly by but not visit her place. So after researching their native habitat and diet, she just started planting and was hooked.
I do have two favourite designs though, and I love using a keyhole design. This is basically just a small cleared open circle in a sunny position surrounded by dense ground covers and shrubs. And inside that circle, it's a bird bath that goes there, some rocks and a branch, and this is very important as well because this is a place they love to sunbathe. It also has a small little pathway to the circle, and this pathway creates a lovely little window for you to observe the birds in the circle. So they still have their privacy, but yet you get to see all the action that's happening in there, and it's quite amazing what you do see take place in there. And this is all experimental, but it's their favourite place in the garden. They just flock to it. Just a lovely private area for them. I'm starting to feel like a bird. I'm thinking more like one because, yeah, you do become that observant and you just start thinking like them. You start knowing, I guess, what they need.
I've known Leanne online for a few years now. She's just this amazing example of someone who has put in the work and done her research and with love has created this amazing bird-friendly garden. For pretty much everybody, the last 2 years have been really hard because we have been locked down and not able to go anywhere. What has really been highlighted for me, and it's anecdotal, I don't have the data to back it up, was the amount of people that have told me just how important seeing birds in their private space, in their gardens, have been for their mental well-being. So I often talk about bird watching and doing bird surveying as being really important for the birds because we need to be able to see what's happening to them and document changes and whether things we're doing are successful or not. But it's also really important for us as well. And I think we can afford to be a little bit selfish and say we are bird watching for us as well and reaping the benefits of that. And there is more and more evidence coming out in the literature now about how connection to nature helps people. It helps with physical symptoms. It helps with our mental well-being. And so, you know, getting a dose of nature through the pandemic, I think, has been really important for a lot of people.
When I'm home, I'm just never alone. You know, I thought people were like, oh, we can't have visitors at home. And I'm like, I've got 100 today. I've got, you know, 120 visitors dropping in today. Having birds in your life, you're just never alone. And, you know, I'd have a magpie who's become quite friendly. I mean, I don't feed the birds, but she's quite a lovely little bird. She's been coming in to my garden probably for the past 3 or 4 years, and she doesn't have her babies here, but she'll bring them in here. I think she uses my garden like a childcare center, and then she goes off with her partner for sometimes 4 hours, 5 hours, and her young ones are just in here, you know, lazing about, learning how to forage, I guess, you know, all those little life skills they need to learn, and they can do that in a safe place. And I believe she knows that. And just before nesting season, I always give her some of my hair. You know, I'll cut some of my hair and she just takes that from me. She's very friendly. Oh, and in the mornings, I just couldn't imagine not waking up to a bird symphony, just those songs in the morning. And here in Wambara, it usually starts with the laughing kookaburra, followed by the little superb fairy wrens, which is quite sweet. And that all takes place outside my bedroom window. It's also that beautiful chorus every morning that reminds me to feel grateful for another day and for all the benefits the birds bring to my life. It really instills in me the urge to continue to protect and nurture the bird life in my garden.
My real connection with birds was from 20 years of tour guiding through the beautiful Northern Territory, where I was coming across things like brolgas and jabiroos, black-necked storks that are sort of as tall as I am, and amazing connection there, and also working with local Indigenous people on country and just amazing insight into that local knowledge, and once again connecting to country through birds. Everyone wants to be part of it. Everyone wants to learn more about birds. It's quite addictive once you start on that journey of understanding what birds are around you. You can find yourself at all hours of the day and night hearing a bird, seeing something fly past. You're suddenly reaching for binoculars. You're reaching for guidebooks. You're busily trying to identify it. You're sending texts to your mates and your colleagues saying, what was this? Any ideas? So great way to share knowledge and share experiences and know that you're contributing to, you know, long-term significant conservation practices that are hopefully going to make sure our kids and our kids' kids are going to enjoy birds in the landscape for a long time.
Ben has a long history with birds, having worked in Central Australia as a tour guide, and now brings that passion to working with rural landowners to protect several threatened woodland bird species.
So as part of our Birds on Farms program in southern New South Wales, supported by the Saving Our Species program, New South Wales Government, with co-investment from Foundation of National Parks and Wildlife, our project's called Saving the Nectar Lovers, and we're focusing on three target species there that have all been identified as vulnerable or declining in New South Wales, and they are the dusky wood swallow, the little lorikeet and the black-chinned honeyeater. And these are all, as the name of the project suggests, nectar lovers. The dusky wood swallow will also focus on other forms of food like insects, but it really highlights the importance of halting that habitat decline and degradation, and preserving things like those really big old paddock trees that produce huge amounts of nectar and a really high quality nectar for these species that are nomadic, seasonally dispersive throughout the landscape. So things like the black-chinned honeyeater, it's only 16 centimetres tall, and overnight they can lose sort of 25% of their body mass. So by morning, they're knocking on death's door, and they really need to find some nectar and some high quality nectar fast. Otherwise, they're in all sorts of trouble. So they're moving throughout the landscape. They're not something that we see consistently throughout our quarterly surveys, but we hope to see them around those flowering times. The little lorikeets are the same. They're about the same size, like a flying dim sim, if you can imagine that. Very short tail, not as much colour as the rainbow lorikeet, but once again, seasonally dispersive and really dependent on not only the nectar from those large paddock trees, but sometimes the dead paddock trees, which are really important to retain on property for their nesting hollows, which, you know, the dusky wood swallows will also use, and really dependent on those sort of resources. So if we can inspire people and work with people who are helping to protect those resources, we can hopefully maintain those populations into the future.
The Saving the Nectar Lovers program is recruiting new landowners, as well as some that were involved in the early days back when the Birds on Farm program first started in 1997. One of those farming families is Neville and Jan Lubke.
My name's Neville Lubke. Now we've got to wind the clock back probably 65 years, but I remember it like it was 6 minutes ago. A significant memory. I remember sitting in a Chev 4 ute and my mother at the wheel. We'd fed cows and we pulled up at a clump of box timber. Mum pointed down to the ground and she said, "Nev, look at the curlews." And that's my first memory of the Bushstone curlews when I was 4 years of age. And I've been privileged to live alongside those birds ever since. Our property name is Bonnie Rise, which is 20 kilometres north of Albury. Our enterprises are red meat production. We have Murray Grey cattle and Pole Dorset sheep. So that's the heart and soul of what we do.
I'm Jan Lubke, and I was lucky enough to marry the boy next door. And I've been here almost 50 years, and I see the farm as an extension of my garden. So we love to make the farm more beautiful and enjoy the aesthetic surroundings that we live in. We feel very blessed to be here. I guess I got my awakening to being an avid birder when I married Nev, because he's always been keen on birds and been involved in keeping parrots and rosellas. And my background was a veterinary nurse, so I guess I was always animal mad anyway, so I sort of slotted in very well to the farm.
We've always been madly passionate about enhancing our property, both with flora and fauna. So opportunities now to get assistance is increasingly difficult, and Birds on the Farm's initiative certainly addresses those things. And just to rub shoulders with like-minded people without anything else is important to us.
There is a lot of financial pressure on farmers nowadays to get every dollar out of every centimetre of soil they can. But we've found by enhancing the landscape out in the paddocks, I don't believe we have lost any production. In fact, I think it's actually helped. So there's a bit of a mindset barrier that needs to be broken through, and hopefully our farm can be a bit of an example to others that it is still possible to survive without having to use every inch of ground you've got.
The initial Birds on Farm program started in 1995, back when Australia's landcare movement was growing in popularity amongst rural landholders. Landcare's focus is on sustainable agriculture and ecosystem restoration, and Birds on Farm was a fact-finding mission to discover what effect this was having on biodiversity and bird populations in rural areas, specifically on private land.
We identified in the initial Victorian project that there were quite a lot of gaps in knowledge. A lot of data has been historically recorded from public land, and the Birds on Farms program has been a real window, if you like, or insight into bird populations on private land. So we know that by maintaining the biodiversity, we're contributing to enhancing the natural assets of those properties, which then can lead to all sorts of flow-on effects, which affects the bottom line and the profitability and sustainability of that farming enterprise. The contribution the birds can make to enhancing the biodiversity on a farm is to obviously control pests naturally. Both introduced pests and native pests is a major role of the birds. It's also distributing nutrients, contributing back to the soil to promote the health of the soil, but also contribute a lot to the whole ecosystem, raising the natural assets of that farm, but also the flow-on effects from the revegetation and restoration efforts of our committed landholders to try and create not only bird habitat, but habitat for biodiversity. Those restoration projects like shelter belts and enhancing dams has a real flow-on effect to improving water clarity and reducing pollution, maintaining soil, improving health of soil. Lots of flow-on effects that not only enhance the natural assets of the farm, but contribute to that profitability and sustainability of that enterprise.
Well, initially when we started with the land care, we identified patches on our property that were unproductive, probably picked out some of the most adverse sites farm-wise and began to fence them off and plant them out, which in hindsight was a baptism of fire, I think. We'd have been better off to start with the most well-drained, beautiful sites that we could have put our hands on. But it was all a learning curve.
Yes, you must always put the fence up before you plant the trees. Otherwise the stock get in and they eat the trees or pull them out. Not that the stock are meant to be there, but a gate gets left open and in they come. So that's number one, is you always fence before you plant the trees. I always like to put tree guards around the trees because I spent an age planting one morning. I went back after lunch and the galahs had nipped off a heap of the trees already. So as we plant, the trees get guarded, protects them from the rabbits and the hares as well as the galahs and the cockatoos. Also using species that are suitable. When we first started, we looked at the guidebook and picked out all the beautiful flowering trees. Remembering I'm extending my garden to the farm. And a lot of them grow naturally in Western Australia, so they weren't suitable for us here in the Eastern Riverina. So they nearly all died.
The last point Jan brought up is a massive one. It's suiting what you plant to the land. Certainly we've got a lot of wet sites, and that narrows down the opportunities of species, whereas a well-drained site's open the barn door pretty wide.
So we've now got species that suit our area, and we plant those, and they work well. They attract the local birds. And they still look beautiful.
The benefits of birds on farm. Can you sort of describe to me for yourself as a landowner, from a production perspective, are there any benefits that you can speak to?
Well, it's very hard to put a measurement on some of the benefits that we regard as important. Weight gain in having stock shelter is important. I can quote a very hot summer where lambs belonging to another landowner stop gaining weight in heatwave conditions. Ours continue to put on 300 grams a day, all due to shelter. So that's one example of money in the pocket.
Another saving benefit of the plantations has been when we've had bad weather post-shearing and lots of other people have lost shorn sheep, like immediately after shearing with bad weather. We have had occasions where we've actually opened the gate and we put all the shorn sheep into the tree lines and we haven't lost a sheep. In a dry year, you'll lose a bit of production next to the tree row, but then you could also argue in a wet year, it saved that little bit of crop from getting too waterlogged. So in the long term, we don't think we've lost production at all.
There's one really important one you can't really put a value on, and that's the feel-good aspect. We drive around our farm and we're out there every day, and it does the soul good. I mean, things don't always go right. Some days are diamonds and some are stones, like Neil Diamond sang. And even on the days that are stones, the beauty of the property is still there. And we're enjoying the fruit of our labour now. We're seeing trees that are matured out and the understory coming along well. In this last 18 months, whatever, of coronavirus, one hasn't been able to go anywhere else much. We've been able to spend lots of time in our paddock enjoying the beauty of them.
For Neville and Jan, it's clear that the work they've done to bring back the birds has benefited them and their business too. Benefits aside, the birds are a great way to connect to country because they act as an indicator species about the broader health of the surrounding landscapes.
Bird watching is a fantastic way of connecting to country, and I think being out there on country all day, the landholders provide a huge amount of local knowledge and bring that to our project and to our conservation efforts for trying to restore and increase capabilities of the bird populations continuing into the future. It's quite an addictive pastime, bird watching. I find when we're watching and listening birds, we're putting ourselves in the position of those birds. We're asking ourselves, where's my next feed coming from? Where can I find shelter? Where are my mates? Where's the nearest water? And by asking ourselves these questions helps connect us to country. And I think our landholders are really well connected to country. They know when they go outside if something doesn't look right, if something doesn't feel right underfoot, if something doesn't smell right, they know there's an imbalance.
You're right, the birds are an indicator of the health of the landscape. And we can go to properties where they haven't done planting and they do a lot of intensive cropping and clearing and chemical spraying, and you'll hardly hear much bird life there at all. The place just strikes me as it's not dead, but it seems dead because there's no life from the birds around. And you'll come here with the plantations like where we were this morning, and it's just a chorus of birds' calls, and they're only there because of the revegetation, and we provided them with a suitable habitat to live in.
The area I came from, northwest of here, I go back there occasionally and I look at properties that I grew up in among, and I can show you country there where there's not a live tree in existence anymore on virtually entire properties. And I'm thinking, what's rural Australia going to look like eventually if what I call the golden oldies, those remnant trees that are there, maybe hundreds of years old, disappearing from the landscape? There's a golden opportunity there to do something that's disappearing before our very eyes. I'm not worried about what anybody says regarding our particular property. When we started planting trees, we were probably the joke of the district. But now, in hindsight, my only regret is we didn't do more of it sooner. And I can see that the golden chance there with the old trees, they're a chance for your cheapest regeneration. All it requires is a bit of fencing and the sacrifice of some of your country.
If there's an opportunity for funding to do some re-veg work, go for it. I've got quite good at putting in applications because it is expensive. And if you can't get some assistance, which is getting harder all the time to get now with the finances tightening up, it costs a lot of money to put up a fence to protect that old tree, and that's what you need to be doing. But even if you can't do it on a large scale, you can do something on a small scale. So start small if that's what it takes. And if you can only do something small, still do it, because you are somebody that can do something. One thing I'll add, and it's not why we do it, but I'm also sure all the work we've done has increased the capital value of our land. Because, you know, if it ends up that way, which I guess it will, that it gets split up, people are going to come along, and rather than just seeing a vacant block of land, they're going to see a block of land with flowering trees and shrubs and birds and a nice outlook and a nice place to live. So I'm sure we've added to the capital value of the land, but said that's not why we did it. We did it for ourselves and for the environment.
For Neville and Jan, focusing on the birds and nature has had multiple benefits, from productivity and landscape resilience to improving their well-being and adding capital value to the property. And these last two benefits ring true whether you're in the bush or the burbs.
There is evidence that shows your house values are tied into the space you create, and that includes the garden and the outside, not only the inside of our gardens. And, you know, for many people now that's a challenge because, you know, there's big houses on small blocks and there's not really space for many gardens anymore. But there is evidence that shows, you know, if you can create these sort of green spaces, then there are economic benefits.
I can happily say that all my landscaping efforts of creating a beautiful oasis for the bird life, I believe, have added a significant value to my home. The feedback about the garden alone has been so overwhelming. It definitely has made a strong impact to all the potential buyers, I guess. You know, with all the mature trees as well and all that privacy, it's just something that can't be created overnight. So beautiful gardens take years to evolve, and this is why I think they are highly valued when selling. So we go to auction in 2 weeks, and I don't know how I'm feeling about that. I'm not attached to the house, but on the other hand, I'm attached to the bird life. So it's a sort of bittersweet situation. When it comes to all the birds and animals who I have shared my life with over these past 10 years, so many friendships have been formed in the most interesting ways, and it's really hard to have to say goodbye. And I guess what's really sad is not knowing what lies ahead for them.
Leanne's next move is to realise her dream home in a rural setting, where she'll no doubt create more beautiful bird habitat and make heaps of new friends along the way. But before she leaves her current nest, she's putting together a guide for the new owners about their feathered friends and nocturnal neighbours.
Wildlife who make homes in our suburban gardens usually only have that one home, and it would be very hard for them to survive if their homes and habitats were destroyed. So I think this manual has been comforting for me to work on. So in this way, I can be their voice as they don't have one. They can't speak up for their homes. And by doing this, my only hope is that I inspire the new owners to really see who they will be sharing the land with and how important all the native flora is for their survival. Yeah, this will hopefully make the new owners think twice before destroying any habitats that are so important to the birds and hundreds of other species. And I guess by leaving this manual, I feel very hopeful that after I'm gone, that all the bird life will continue to be nurtured.
I always like to think of our immediate space, like our house or our townhouse, that we're sharing this space. We might pay the mortgage or pay the rent, but we share this with wildlife, and we should remember that and think about what we can do to create spaces that we both enjoy. There are features you can add. There is ways to style a garden. Any plant is going to be helpful, particularly if it's native. So I guess reminding people that you do share even your city block with a huge amount of wildlife means that there are benefits for you, and there are actions that you can take that will help them and make you feel better about yourself as well.
I think that's what a lot of landholders get from being involved in our Birds on Farms program, is that reassurance that they're doing their bit and providing a legacy for generations to come by contributing where they can, and also a social aspect. It's a great opportunity for us to get out on people's private residence and bring some volunteers and bring some neighbouring landholders and all get together and use the birds as a real focus, not only for raising awareness, but connecting to each other and connecting to country.
And I think it's so important that we nurture our bird life in our suburban environments, because they really need our backyards. And when we do this, we too are nurtured back. So now who wouldn't want a little of that every day?
This podcast has been produced by the Grow Love Project, with support from the New South Wales Government's Saving Our Species program. To hear more episodes, make sure to subscribe to this podcast. And for more information about the Saving Our Species program, visit savingourspecies.online/help SOS. Thanks for listening.